Welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast which has never found itself weirdly distracted by the sight of the Venus de Milo. I'm Nathan.
I'm Todd.
I'm Simon.
And I'm a sacrificial Scaglione Mona Lisa for this one.
Well, implausibly enough, the Doctor, Amy and Rory have arrived at Apalapuchia during a global pandemic. And when their cosplay reenactment of the Ark in Space Part 1 goes horribly wrong, it looks like the cheerful, genial, carefree Amy we've grown to love will be lost forever under a massive layer of latex. Can the Doctor resolve this paradox? Let's find out as we discuss The Girl Who Waited. Want to start by saying I think that the setup makes no sense, and I don't normally care about these things at all, but I don't know what this wretched quarantine facility is supposed to be doing.
Isn't it supposed to be allowing people who have one day to live to basically live out the rest of their life?
Exactly. I'm pining for budget departure lounges as we speak. that one day that stretches into what feels like eternity. Who would have thought we would long for such things?
I think it's the Millennium Center, isn't it? It's the lobby and sort of upstairs.
Really? I thought it was Cardiff National Airways.
It has featured very prominently as another hospital in New Earth, I think. We have certainly sort of seen that area before. So it is meant to allow people who have a day to live a sort of long life in that day. And that's the effect that we see.
It's so poignant.
If they have only a day to live and the time is speeded up, why is the sort of advancement of the disease not speeded up as well?
Well, it's clear that Amy, when she was waiting 2 weeks or 3 weeks or however long it was in that first advance that she has, she says, you know, the doctor asks, what did you eat? And she says, well, I didn't feel hungry. And so it's obvious to me anyway that all those things, like it's probably in the 36 odd years that Amy's there that she doesn't even have a sandwich to keep her going. It's like, you know, people on television never having to go to the toilet. The same principle applies here.
Yes, okay. So I'm with that. So there is some kind of metabolic thing happening that means that they really sort of actually only experience a day. They're probably a bit peckish by the end of it, you know, at the end
I
of the day.
I suspect so.
Yes, but they're distracted by Disneyland Clom and various other things. So that sort of keeps them going. I was very, very confused, and it's the first time I've even thought to wonder.
Reminds me of a Star Trek Voyager or TNG episode.
It does. I thought that too.
It really is.
Is there a specific one?
No, just a feeling.
I think there's a Voyager episode called Wink of an Eye. Did I dream that? Or Blink of an Eye? I can't remember which of those.
Mid-season budget special, I believe it's also called.
Yeah, that's right. It does have a very sort of high concept Star Trek feel to it in a way that is a little bit unusual for Doctor Who. But I felt that way initially about Amy's choice last year as well. I thought that that was not really a traditional sort of Doctor Who approach.
Closely observed story of a tight cast.
Yeah.
May I say, this is one of my favourites of the season, and watching it again, I like it even more than I did the first time.
I agree.
Yeah, I loved it, and it only gets better on repeated viewings.
because it allows the actors to show us the reason they're on screen. They're great performers and they have a brilliant dynamic and empathy with each other. And it's a superb episode. I also think Tom McRae is very good. I'm surprised at the subtleties. It shouldn't work. It's a bit hokey. And as you said, it actually feels, I don't even know if it's Voyager, it feels more Lower Decks with less jokes. In that it just feels one of those tightly confined things that feels as if it's a lampoon of the show itself, or it starts off that way. And, oh, look, there's a choice, there's a lift. Oh, we're in a white room. It's so meta. And again, Matt Smith and the Doctor will also throw in a few of those lines just to show that, oh, no, it's all a bit light. And then suddenly we're facing the idea of aging alone and being separated from those we love and having to survive in our heads. And you didn't mention lockdown, did you, Nathan? So I shan't.
But I think, Nathan, if I can say, and Todd, I think the reason it feels like a bit like a Star Trek episode, and I don't think it's just the art direction. I think it's the fact that it's one of those examples of the new series doing a 45-minute episode, which feels like it's designed to be a 45-minute episode, and that, of course, is what the Star Trek format is.
Yeah.
I think I've had this conversation many times, I know, but I'll bring it up again. I think for me, when modern Doctor Who is unsatisfactory is when it's trying to do a story of the scope of the classic series in terms of length, but squishing it into 45 minutes. Sometimes that works, but sometimes it's just unsatisfactory. I think when the new series is spectacular, The Doctor's Wife, for instance, another one notable from this season, it's when it's doing something that the original series never touched because it works in the 45-minute format.
Yeah, you certainly, I think, couldn't do this as a four-parter.
No, it'd be terrible.
Yeah.
This is one of my three favourite episodes of the season, if I don't count the Christmas Carol Christmas special. The other's been The Doctor's Wife and next week's episode, The Gold Complex, which I think is extraordinary. But my big question is, like, would you have pushed the green button or the red button? Like I just would have normally gone for green. I don't know why. I just think that's really funny.
Yeah.
And the Doctor's coat. This is the first time he wears that long coat.
No, he actually wore it. Where did he wear it?
Let's Kill Hitler.
In Let's Kill Hitler, yeah. Mm. Yes, we did have a discussion of it back then, and Simon was not a fan, I seem to remember.
No. I love the line of the original.
No, Jodie wasn't the first Doctor to go to the op shop. Do you remember Army Surplus in the 80s when there was a battalion of students wearing these things? Yeah.
Yeah, it was definitely a thing.
Often role-playing gamers, weren't they?
Well, I'm feeling a bit attacked right now. You mentioned The God Complex, Todd, and this is, I think, Nick Hurren's first episode as director, and he will do The God Complex next week. And I think he does an extraordinary job. He will be back. I mean, he does the Angels of Manhattan and Asylum of the Daleks next year.
And then Day of the Doctor. But I think all these episodes have the way it's filmed and the light and the locations. I think he's a great director. I really do. I can see why he's brought back.
Yeah, the white rooms, which could look really cheesy, and in the classic series when it sort of attempted to do white rooms to do sort of ultra-modern things, the lighting wasn't up to it and perhaps the people painting the sets weren't as careful as they might have been, and it never...
They'd usually be footprints.
Yeah, that's right. It never, ever quite comes off. But here I think it's just beautifully done, and there's an incredible shot actually where the TARDIS is seen through the doors, so the doors are the first thing that Rory sees when the TARDIS door opens, and they're just sort of perfectly framed. Like, everything is very symmetrical, everything is very clinical, and I think it looks amazing. And just the fact that those buttons are just essentially lift buttons, you know, they're not space buttons or anything like that, they are exactly what we see every day. I think it works really well. And in scenes where you have, for instance, two Amy speaking to one another, he finds interesting ways of doing that, of, you know, of getting us to see both of their faces, for instance, in those scenes. He's really extraordinary. He's responsible for a lot of the look of Sherlock, I think, and it is, I think, a much bigger departure from the way that Doctor Who has been directed before than it seems initially.
I'll just use the word elegant.
Mm.
I think that's, for me, the word that summarizes the style. It's not showy, it's not over the top, but everything feels like it's placed perfectly.
I mean, there are extraordinary shots, though, like and very strange things. I think about, you know, there's a conversation that old Amy has through the TARDIS door with Rory where it almost looks like they're touching, and it is just a sort of strange fade. There's some wipes. There's all sorts of, you know, things that Doctor Who doesn't normally do, but they're not intrusive. And, yeah, maybe elegant is the right word for it.
Design-wise, it's actually mannerist. Not just with the White Gardens, but also with the topiary. There was that period after, anyway, in the 18th century, when everyone was painting their houses all ivory and doing this sort of thing to their gardens. And you're right with the swipes, because there's a whole period of French cinema that does a very similar thing with very staged shots, you know, right through the, very composed, very, very studied, assumed and mannered. These things don't last long as a period of design and interior. Cyrie Maugham did it to the whole, Somerset Maugham's wife apparently did it to the whole thing. And Noel Coward said, everyone looks anemic, you can't touch a thing. It doesn't last long as a design trend. But it's definitely the style of this, and that kind of removal that a cinema maker or a filmmaker puts in when you're aware of stylistic qualities of it, I think really serves this, because that little bit of removal when you're noticing the camera tricks, or you're noticing the position of the camera, or you're noticing the subtleties of it, it pulls you away and gives you a moment to breathe. I think it works really well with this sort of thing when you're encouraged to be so close to the characters.
Yeah, I mean, you basically just have the three regulars, don't you? You've got Imelda Staunton as a voice. You've got the projected woman kind of behind the reception desk, and that's about it, isn't it? And the hand bots who have no kind of character.
I never realised it was Imelda.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was only when the closing credits come up that we went, oh, my goodness.
Yeah, well, we had Michael Sheen earlier on this season doing a voiceover, and now we have Imelda Staunton doing one. So it's
just like Frasier.
It's a way of getting shoehorning. Yes, that's right. A big name in who might otherwise not have wanted to spend a lot of time in makeup, I think.
Obviously, Karen spends a lot of time in makeup, or doesn't, as the case may be. I actually do think that even on a rewatch, the prosthetics on her, I just wanted to be a bit older. I mean, I know that sounds incredible to say that.
She's our age.
Yeah, I was thinking that.
I think she looks overdone. She looks overcooked. No, I love the prosthetics.
I don't think that high definition is very kind to them, I have to say.
It's very difficult to do that on the budget and the time and to get it at all effective. But she also does it, the actress herself does it, with the position of her face and the way her expressions and pulling back. And obviously you can't emote too much when you've got a face covered in Zygon.
It's funny, maybe I've got lower standards, but I actually thought that it was really, really good aging prosthetic. And also, I'm glad that they didn't age her too much. Like, it felt sort of almost understated rather than comedy aging. And I think that made it more powerful, and probably does allow, just touching on what Richard's saying, probably does allow the actress to emote a little bit more through facial expressions, where heavier aging makeup might prevent that.
I think she's extremely good, and this is obviously her episode to shine. And I think old Amy is properly different from our Amy. And it's also fun to see little moments of our Amy break through in that performance. You know, when she smiles, when she laughs, you know, her first laugh in 36 years about the doctor's fares. And that's a little bit of whiplash, isn't it? Because we get the relief of seeing that our Amy is still in there, but she immediately has to tell us that she's had a miserable 36 years sort of straight after that moment, just to kind of make Rory feel worse, I guess. Yeah. I mean, what do you think of the performance?
I think there's an underlying anger in it, and I actually think her performance is great. And going back to the makeup, I think the makeup distracts me from the performance, like, because I want it to be a little bit more than what it actually is, right? And I can see why that they've, you know, they want her to emote through it. But I just get distracted by the differences between them. I just want it to be a bit more. But I really, truly thought it was a tour de force for Karen. The only criticism I'm going to have her entire performance is I don't think she's a natural fighter. And I think, you know, in the fighting sequences, it's very choreographed. And at times I just think she doesn't look natural. Like looks like it's more cut together, you know. But I think she is just phenomenal in this episode, really. And it continues my journey to say that I've reevaluated Karen quite substantially and what she can deliver.
The fight sequences are pretty amazing. Again, it's that sort of dropped frames and use of sort of speeding up and slowing down and stuff like that to make it kind of a bit artificial again, to give you the distance that Richard was talking about and make it a little bit more visually interesting, I think.
What do you do with a ninja cat lady for certain years? I do wish there'd been a canine cameo somehow. It would have felt right, or as a cat. Todd said it. This works because of Karen, and this was a make or break. The whole thing posits on her ability to sell the performance.
But I think when they're also together, you really do see the difference between her normal performance and the older. And it's really
you
quite...
You really do, don't you?
The subtleties really quite extraordinary. And I think... also having Arthur there, because I think he's amazing in this as well.
They shine, yeah.
Just to bounce off, you know, really. Like he allows her to shine. He's a strength, I think, anyway.
Is this a Dr. Light episode?
I think it must be. I was trying to work that out when I was watching it last night. I got that impression because he's basically just in the TARDIS and immediately in the room outside. So it's the sort of semi-light episode.
Yeah.
Yes.
A little bit like Karen in The Lodger, where, you know, you could shoot her stuff in a day and so she's sort of not required for most of the episode. And everything that's very complicated involves Arthur and Karen in particular, who's got makeup and appears twice in the same scene and stuff like that. So they keep Matt Smith out of it a bit. But he's still
rightly so. Yeah, right.
I think he's very, very good in it, though, I have to say.
He takes the attack very well, doesn't he? It's exactly the right pitch. He doesn't argue with her. He knows when to be quiet and when to suffer the righteous indignation. I was really impressed with that scene. You know, when you're on the edge of the sofa, think, don't argue with her. Let her speak. She has every right. She's carried it so successfully. John Woodnut didn't have to deal with all of that egg albumen on his face when he was up for Broton, you know. Hard work.
If I can just touch on, though, what Todd was saying about Arthur and Rory, I think that performance is so good. And one of the things I loved about it was the way it communicates how a relationship can develop over the decades. You know, having myself now been in a relationship for 23 years. I'll get into trouble for that later. Edit that, Nathan.
23 years.
Married legally for two of them, but in a relationship for such a long time. It's amazing how you do see your other half almost through the same eyes as when you first met them, regardless of how much the aging process changes someone physically. And, you know, you look at an old photograph and you're reminded, oh, my God, that's right. They look, you know, this bit about them has physically changed. And so Arthur, Rory, is able to accept the older Amy in a complete way. And even at the end when, you know, he's been tricked by the doctor and they are going to leave the old Amy behind, he still has that connection with her as his wife, of 36 years, effectively. And I think that's just so heartbreaking, I felt.
I think it's a great way to spice up everybody's long-term relationships, shove them in a bit of domaru armor and see what comes about.
Or duplicating them in some way. You don't think?
You want two husbands, do you?
Yeah, no.
One's enough.
There is that moment, though, isn't there, where, and it's the thing that convinces Amy, old Amy, that young Amy really needs to be saved. And she says that it's you were carrying her and you were looking at her the way that you used to look at me. And there's, like, I think the most interesting thing about the episode isn't essentially the kind of moral dilemma at the end, because that really just happens for space reasons, doesn't it? Like, the only reason we can't have more than one Amy in the TARDIS is because that's a rule we made up. There's no kind of...
I've wiped the five doctors as well from my memory.
That's right.
I think it's a little bit more than that. I think it does make a story sense. I mean, I know it's a space reason that you can't have the older Amy coexisting with the young Amy having had a separate life. But, you know, I think we're allowed to have that as a space reason.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that, and I'm glad, though, that that choice isn't taken away from us by the old Amy being killed or anaesthetized by the robots, and so she can't get away. You know, I like the fact that they had to make a choice, or the doctor had to close the door on her. I think that's so powerful.
They do a fake out, though, don't they? Just before the end of it, we see her fighting the robots, and then Rory sort of runs off with Amy before she's sort of anaesthetized, and we think that that's going to be old Amy sacrifices herself nobly so that her younger counterpart and Rory can get away. And that isn't a thing. And I also really like, too, I like the fact that we are told by Matt Smith's performance that he's lying to Rory. And it is just when he just shakes his head subtly when we talk about the prospect of bringing them both back. And then he's really kind of playing it straight. And he, you know, like, we don't know what the rules are. We know probably that they're not going to get Karen to be two Karens and put on aging makeup and stuff for the rest of the season. We know that's probably not going to happen. But, you know, when he starts to talk about the prospect of rescuing them both, and he comes up with all of this sort of techno babble why it might work, we already know that he's not telling the truth.
I can now pick that up in hindsight, but I confess I didn't pick that up while watching it.
Yeah, there's a little moment where he shakes his head when they're discussing the prospect of it. You know, I think Rory might be asking, is it possible? And we just see a shot of Matt looking at that screen and just subtly shaking his head.
But there's no
just
reason
to let
why,
us know.
Yeah, but there's no reason why. I mean, they couldn't have done it. I mean, they could have dropped the old Amy in a parallel universe like they did with the other David Tennant. I mean, you know.
Yeah. She could have ended up on the planet Colchicron, which is my favourite place for dropping people off.
Is that where the Garavis gets dropped off?
It is where he gets dropped off, I mean, they could have done that, but then you lose the kind of thing at the end. But I actually think what is more interesting is the way that Amy convinces the other Amy to rescue her. You know, the old Amy is absolutely adamant that she's not going to permit it to happen. She's had the conversation as the young Amy before, and it didn't turn out that way. And so she decides, and it's Rory is the entire reason for it. You know, this is an episode more than Amy's choice. I think that it is about Amy's relationship with Rory.
Todd, you were saying before that this is one of your favourites of the season. It's actually my favourite of the season, and I'm surprised, you know, myself to say it as a fan. What made it work for you?
Well, I think Karen is that good, but I think Arthur and Rory's journey, his relationship with the wife, and also his relationship with the doctor is very defined in this, you know. He, especially at the end where, you know, he's quite angry at the doctor for turning, you're turning me into you, and he doesn't want that. And I think it underlines their relationship all the way through. He's there with Amy, but not really with the doctor. Like, it's always Amy for him, I think, throughout his entire run, really, in the show. And he obviously has a respect for the doctor in the end, but it's they're never like, you know, it's never the doctor and just Rory. Do you know what I'm saying? And I think he looks wonderful, like with his Rory cam and having the big magnifying glass, like he's like Indiana Jones or whatever. And then we've also got the robot Rory, which is so cute. And
sit down, Rory.
my favorite bit is where they're sort of hugging or crying or something, and robot Rory just sort of turns away to give them a little bit of privacy. I think that's sort of gorgeous. That's actually super telling, isn't it? Because she's initially really hostile to Rory, and it looks like calling the robot Rory is dismissive, and she even refers to him as her pet. And that's always this sort of ugly suspicion we have about the relationship, is that Amy just bosses Rory around and treats him really kind of terribly and stuff like that. But it absolutely establishes that that's not what the relationship is at all.
I think that's one of the things here, is that what you've just said, you think that's where it's going, but then it actually doesn't go there. Like, it actually shows you and emphatically how much she loves him and their relationship, whereas there's other episodes that make me frustrated because it's like, you're treating him like dirt and you're not showing me that you really love him. But here I think it really does.
It's also, I think, an acknowledgement that, and I think there has to be some sort of acknowledgement that there's going to be some sort of resentment that she's been left there for decades, left behind, as it were, again. And so I think you're right, Todd, it communicates it warmly, but I think it also has that slight little, just enough little edge there just to communicate, yes, there is some level of resentment.
It sits uncomfortably in a season, well, nostalgically, in a season where it feels like Philip Hinchcliffe is back, giving our heroine just the right amount of douche that he gave Sarah Jane. I really want, what's going to happen to her next week? She'll be stuck in a bucket, forced to live in a swamp.
She has had a bad time, and this is another.
Rory has to go and save her again.
Not a great year.
Yeah. We talked a little bit in last week's episode about how that plot thread about the abduction of Amy's daughter has kind of gone dormant, and it was for obvious reasons last week, and clearly we don't want to deal with it this week either, but it will obviously be back in a few weeks' time.
The other thing with this episode, I guess the reason why I'm really liking it this time through is because I think maybe the first time or through I was just unsure whether I really liked it as much as I did, because for me, it came on the back of a string of episodes which I don't like. Like, I don't like the gang of stuff. I don't like the two Stephen Moffat episodes with River. I mean, there's some clever stuff in there, but I don't think they hang together. And I really detest last week's episode, sorry. and then you've got the pirate one. And it's just like, besides the Doctor's Wife, like, this is suddenly a really good episode. So sometimes I'm a bit sort of like, is it because I've been so down on things? Is this shining because of that? But I don't think so. I really, really think it just is a beautiful shining beacon of light, you know.
Mm. And I felt that from sort of the moment it starts. There's something about the way it kicks off which establishes this terrible sense of foreboding. When she presses, and we touched on it earlier, you know, Todd, why would you press the red button? Why wouldn't she press the green button? But as soon as she presses the red waterfall, you know something is going to go wrong, and it's going to be an irrevocable decision that's made as soon as she walks through that door. And it's established when then Rory tries to come back and walk through the red anchor door, you know, it doesn't work. And that's kind of reinforced when, you know, after we've established that Amy's timeline is moving at a far faster rate, they go back to the TARDIS and this, you know, 80s bedside digital clock radio is clicking over at this absolutely rapid rate. And it just makes me, that sort of time disappearing like that just makes me sick to my stomach every time I watch it. It's so subtle but so disturbing.
Simon, did you think of I was trying to remember the title, elevated to the gallows, Ascenseur pour l'échafaud.
Oh, I'm not familiar with that, sorry.
Anyway, it's Louis Malle. It's that French film where illicit lovers become trapped in an elevator and there's a murder plot. It's Miles Davis did the score. It's a beautiful piece of new wave cinema. And there are some nods to that in this, in the way the shots are composed. So there's lots of great cred and history in this. This isn't an accidental episode. Mm. I'm with Todd when he says this just feels artfully done, whereas all the others feel like a panic response to having to do some wild story arcs and get some drama in. This is real drama because it's about the relationship of two people.
And that thing about choice, you know, there's a story about human nature where in the original novel, Paul Cornell makes the, you know, the little, instead of a watch, it's a cricket ball, I think. And it's Russell's decision to make it a watch because you can decide to open it. And so you can physically see a decision being made just by a prop. And then that thing where you have two buttons, there's no reason to prefer one over the other. You just pick one at random and just the consequences of that are so great. And we've seen a hint of it in Aliens of London, of all things, where, you know, the doctor sets the TARDIS a bit wrong and suddenly 18 months have passed and, you know, Jackie's life has been kind of ruined and all of that. And just the sort of the momentous nature of what the doctor does. And I adore that speech where Rory shouts at him and says, you think you could get a history book out and just find out whether there's a global pandemic on the planet that we're about to land. You know, the doctor's incredible kind of casual disregard of things and the way that time travel in this era is able to have these sort of incredible bizarre consequences. So just magnifying that tiny binary choice into this sort of 36-year nightmare just because you press the wrong button. It's really terrifically interesting, I think.
Amy's very skilled because she's managed to make a sonic probe as well.
Yes.
I mean, is she really that good?
Yeah, and reprogramming the interface as well. She manages to do that somehow.
And not eat, as you've said. So there's a few little things here that I find very Star Trek-y that you gloss over those things or they're in there and that's fine, you know. It's probably why it's not my favourite of the season.
I like the sonic probe because it is used as a character thing because she calls it a sonic probe, not a sonic screwdriver, because she hates the doctor. And then she eventually grudgingly admits that it is a sonic screwdriver.
This is exactly how I wanted the 13th Doctor to be portrayed.
Really sort of samurai style.
Curmudgeonly and slightly furious with the world, and there's probably a cat there somewhere, probably a whole troop of them. But yes, and a nice nod to the 6th Doctor's sonic probe there too.
What do we think of the threat? What do we think of the hand bots?
Love it.
Especially when you encounter the secondary injection system.
That is so needles. Good.
Yeah.
That looks properly terrifying. Because, I mean, they're kind of ludicrous. You just need to – they're another sort of Doctor Who monster that you can stroll briskly away from. and I guess it's just the sort of numbers of them that teleport in and kind of block your path and stuff. But that secondary injection system, which just looks like a sort of big Dalek gun coming out of a face with these teeth, like, you know, like it's so incredibly great.
Who designed that? Who is part of the medical fraternity of this relaxation kindness hospice was thinking, how can we what will our altruist numbers, you know?
it does add to the whole sinister nature of it because, remember, the robots aren't actually there to deliberately try and kill or harm her. It's a kindness. And as the doctor says, their kindness will kill you because, you know, she's of a different species. It goes back to what I was trying to say about the Let's Kill Hitler things when we were doing that episode, the antibody amoeba things in the Tesselect or whatever it was called. The catchphrase that they were having was so obvious and basic. This one is, you know, this is a kindness, do not be alarmed. It's the exact opposite of that. It's an actual nice thing to say, but it's so threatening and menacing because you know that the kindness will kill her. And this is what I was trying to say during the Let's Kill Hitler episode, that it was all a bit too obvious, right? Whereas this has got that extra layer in it, which makes it so much more interesting.
No, I agree.
There's something towards the end as well where it sort of takes on a secondary meaning too, as if releasing Amy from 36 years of her kind of torment and stuff like that, the sort of results of that just random decision that she made, releasing her from the sort of torment of that is accompanied by the idea that they're doing her a kindness. So I think it does sort of take on a secondary meaning.
Something that I really like about this is that there's elements of this that come back into play perhaps in season 10, like the room full of all the doors that Amy has to go through reminds me of Bill and Nardole having the room full of different doors in that trilogy episode. And obviously we get the magnificent garden where Missy is.
Is that the same location, is it?
Yeah. And also some of the dialogue, like, I was waiting, I waited for you. This is something that Stephen will bring back with Bill very much later on. So there's just little moments in here for me, having obviously, you know, watched so far ahead, that they just sort of take back or rework, you know, later on, just little elements. And I kind of like that. It's sort of like, oh, wow, you've referenced this, or whether you know it or not, it's come back into play because it's something that's sort of in your subconscious. And that sort of, I just think, underlines how good it is, perhaps, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's that Moffat thing of the timey-wimey-ness once again. I mean, I know it's not a Moffat-written story, but, you know, it's in the Moffat showrunner era. The long way round. Moffat loves to play with the aspect of time which is damaging, which is awful, which, you know, so the long way round in The Girl in the Fireplace, you know, Rory takes the long way round by being the Centurion for 1900 years, whatever it is. You've got Capaldi later in Heaven Sent. As you're sort of mentioning, Todd, these themes keep coming up again and again. And each time they come up, they're usually somewhat terrifying. In fact, even the way Amy and Rory are written out of the program have that aspect as well. It's actually incredibly uncomfortable the more you think about it. And that's why I think it's great.
I really think, I totally agree with you, Simon, there. But I just think some of the dialogue, like, you know, besides, you know, I waited for you and other things that we've mentioned, but, you know, Rory is the most beautiful man I've ever met, or, you know, I'm giving her the days with you. These lines are so affecting, I think. And I think underline a bit of their exit, spoiler alert, at the end of next week. Like, you know, there is a little bit of, I think, underlining build up that they can accept that maybe it is time to move on, because these things keep happening, these bad things, and they get, Rory's having to save Amy again, and she's had to go through all this, and we've had the whole river daughter saga and everything that she's been put through this season. So I actually find that, although it's perhaps not specifically flag posted, I think there is an underlying current here which helps, I think, build to the end of next week as well, I just think, anyway, with their characters and the possibility of moving on from the Doctor.
You know, there is that central scene, which I alluded to before, where the two Amys are speaking and young Amy is trying to convince old Amy to save her. And the whole conversation is around Rory. And it's shot so that we can see both of them at the same time. We can watch them react to one another. And it's another pivotal speech, because it's another choice. You know, it's like Amy's choice between the two buttons at the beginning. It's a choice that's played out and presumably has continued to play out circularly as a result of this whole sort of weird paradox thing. You know, it's happened over and over again, young and old Amy talk. And this time she is broken out of it by Rory, you know, looking over at Rory and saying, do you want to deny him those years with you. And even the point where they, you know, they come together at the end and they have to think one thing, they have to have one thought together, and it's the Macarena, they're doing the Macarena, and you think, oh, there's some zany, wacky Doctor Who nonsense that's just a few years out of date as usual. But then it turns out that that was where their first kiss happened. You know, even that ends up being about their love for Rory and their relationship with Rory. And in a season where, you know, we've seen her sort of play hide and seek with him and run off or dismiss him for being gay or all of that sort of thing, it is actually really great that that love is so central and so apparent, I think, in this episode.
I just found this episode such an easy episode to watch. I know that sounds ridiculous, but I've just had weeks and weeks of not finding it easy to watch episodes. Like, I find them hard slogs or just totally mind confusing or whatever, or just, but I just found it just played out and I just let it wash over me and I just loved it so much.
I was just happy they turned the lights on for once.
Especially after the last one.
Eventually that does get to you, doesn't it? I think the thing about this episode is that it just to echo what Todd was saying, is that it's so easy to watch, but I think it's so easy to watch because it's all on the right level, but it's all on the same level. It's not, there's nothing about it which is confused, and despite the timey-wimey elements, I don't really feel that there's anything about it which is confusing. The visual style is so impactful. And I, just going back to the topiary in the garden, I mean, just the Dr. Seuss-ness of it is just a lovely little thing just to say we are on an alien planet without having stupid space things everywhere. You know, you only need a little bit to communicate that you're somewhere else and somewhere different. And so that's why I think that it is such a good episode, because everyone seems to be working towards the same goal and everyone gets to that goal.
Very much so.
That's all we have time for this week. We'll be back next week to confront our greatest fears again in The God Complex. In the meantime, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts, and you can keep up with us at Flight Through Entirety on Facebook, at FTE Podcast on Twitter, and on our website, flightthroughentirety.com, where you'll find links to our other podcasts, Bondfinger, Jodie Into Terror, Maximum Power, and Untitled Star Trek Project. Until next time, may all the bacteria you're carrying be properly registered and authorized. Thank you very much for listening and good night.
See you soon.
Bye for now.
Good night.
That was Flight Through Entirety, starring Todd Bielby, Nathan Bottomley, Simon Moore and Richard Stone. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb. This episode, The Word Elegant, was recorded on the 29th of August 2021 and released on the 21st of November. If you want to recreate the experience of 36 years alone without having a sandwich or going to the toilet, then I recommend visiting the planet Earth in the year 2020. It might be a good idea to get your shots first.
I just need to drop in a little bit of trivia.
Do this.
For those of you who Wentworth or have watched Wentworth and, you know, a friend of the podcast, Pete McTighe, the girl who waited is one of the nods to Doctor Who he gave to an episode title. I think it was the third episode of Wentworth that he called The Girl Who Waited, and others being Fear Her and Hell Bent. So, I thought that has to be mentioned.
It does.
Surely there was a Love and Monsters as well.
I don't know. There might have been. If there wasn't, there certainly should have been.
Yeah.
And a Gunfighters, I hope.
Yeah, well, prison in space.
Yes. But I think the thing about this episode is that it just to echo what